We proceeded by fiacre directly to the hospital, where a note in Freud's handwriting secured us the custody of the patient. She was much improved physically, but still spoke not a word. Where are we taking her, Holmes?
All in good time, Watson. All in good time.
He smiled reassuringly at our client, but she stared straight ahead, her blue-gray eyes vacantly devoid of expression. The fiacre crossed the Danube Canal and entered a section of the city occupied by palatial residences. We stopped at length on Wallensteinstrasse and turned into a wide drive that led to a house situated on a slight rise of ground. A closed carriage stood beneath the porte cochere, and as we handed down our client, the door to the house opened, and out stepped a gentleman of medium height with the straightest back I have ever seen. Though dressed in mufti, his movements bore that unmistakable precision one associates not merely with the military, but with the strictest Prussian training. His face struck me as vaguely familiar.
Do you recall having seen that gentleman recently?
Yes, but I can't for the life of me think where. Holmes, whose house is this?
It is the Vienna residence of Baron von Leinsdorf.
Holmes, this is monstrous.
Why so? The Baron is not here at the moment.
Yeah?
I am Sherlock Holmes. Kindly tell the Baroness we are here to see her.
In a moment, bitte.
But if the Baron should return, you've no idea what harm this confrontation might do to the lady. Surely you ought to have discussed the matter with Doctor...
My dear Watson, time is of the essence. And if it is possible, we must force a play. In any event, she does not appear to be reacting to the sight of the house. Who knows? If she does, it may turn out to be just the sort of shock to get her back on her feet.
If you will follow me, I shall conduct you to the Baroness.
We had need of a guide. The place was so labyrinthine. When we arrived, we found the beautiful woman we had glimpsed the previous evening at the opera.
Mr. Sherlock Holmes, I believe. To what do I owe that? Good God! Is it Nora? What has happened? She's very changed.
You know the lady?
Know her? Why, to be sure I know her. This is my personal maid, Nora Simmons. She's been missing for weeks without a trace. Oh, great heavens, Nora, what has happened? And how ever did you contrive to reach Vienna?
I fear you will find her unable to answer your questions. She is in a catatonic state, resulting from the shock of having been abducted and held against her will.
But this is monstrous. She was abducted.
So it would appear. Do I understand you to say that she accompanied your ladyship to Bavaria?
She never left my side from the moment we sailed, except for her days off. It was under those circumstances that she disappeared some 3 weeks ago.
The day of the Baron's death?
Why, yes. Nora was not in the villa when the misfortune occurred. She was in the town below us, Ergelsbach, I believe it is called. In the confusion, she was not missed. In any case, it was her day off. When she did not return the following morning, I thought that perhaps, having learned of the tragedy, she had for some reason fallen into a panic. Hers was an excitable and nervous disposition, as I had good cause to know. When she failed to return and sent no word of farewell, I began to fear something untoward had occurred and informed the police.
You suspected foul play?
I did not know what to think.
And the police were unable to discover the whereabouts of your maid?
They could do nothing. Dear girl, how relieved I am to find you.
May one inquire in what manner your husband met his death?
His heart.
I am sorry to hear it. Well, it appears our business here is finished, Watson. We have solved our little mystery. Madame, we are sorry to have intruded upon your grief and valuable time.
But surely you are not taking her from me. I have only just regained her, and I assure you, Mr. Holmes, she is essential to my happiness.
In her present condition, she could hardly be of use to you. She needs to be looked after, not to look after others.
Oh, but I shall look after her myself. Have I not said that she is my companion as well as my servant?
I'm afraid such a solution is quite impossible at present, as your maid is under the care of Dr. Sigmund Freud at the Allgemeines Krankenhaus.
But...
On the other hand, it is just possible that I can persuade the doctor to release the woman into your custody. In Providence, you no doubt involved yourself in church work among the destitute and homeless.
I was very active in parish work of that sort.
I thought as much. You may rest assured I will communicate that fact to Dr. Freud, and he will no doubt consider it when the time comes to decide upon the proper disposition of his patient. Goodbye.
Good day, Mark.
A very excellent performance, Watson. One in which sheer nerve and ingenuity were matched with the consummate artistry of an Ellen Terry. Of course, they were prepared for this sort of eventuality. The woman has been cleverly coached.
She was an imposter, then?
This wretched woman here with us is the bona fide Baroness von Leinsdorf, for all the good it will do her. Yet we may, before this business is done, be able to restore some of her rights. Not her sanity.
How do you know the other is lying?
It may interest you, Watson, to know that the Slaters of Rhode Island have for more than 200 years belonged to the religious sect known as Quakers. The telegram I received confirmed that. Quakers do not attend church. They go to meeting, and they certainly would not refer to charity work as parish work. Oh, and incidentally, I have just recalled where we saw Count von Schlieffen before.
Count who?
Von Schlieffen, Watson, von Schlieffen. The gentleman who passed us as we came in. His sketch appeared in the Times some month ago. Did you not see it? If my memory serves, he has just been named chief of the German General Staff.
That evening, we gathered in the study of Berggasse 19.
I believe, Dr. Freud, you're going to tell us that the will leaves everything to the new Baroness.
If you knew the provision of the Baron's will, you might have said so.
Your morning has not been wasted. Your data have confirmed my suspicions. The time has now arrived to marshal our facts and see if they're covered by our theories. Let me ask you one final question, however, before I pronounce my case complete. What manner of man is Germany's Kaiser?
He is bright, apparently, but excitable, given to fits of impatience with those around him. Actually, I have had a theory about the Kaiser for some time now.
I shall be most interested in hearing it.
You may have known, either from seeing pictures of him or from reading on the subject, that the Kaiser possesses a withered arm.
A withered arm?
It has occurred to me that perhaps the Kaiser's insistent emphasis on displays of strength, his love of colourful uniforms, the parades, the medals with which he adorns himself, it occurred to me that these bellicose loves are all in some way manifestations of his feelings of personal inadequacy. They might all be construed as an elaborate compensation for the withered arm.
This is most remarkable. You know what you've done? You've succeeded in taking my methods, observation and inference, and applied them to the inside of a subject's head.
Scarcely a subject. In any event, your methods, as you refer to them, are not covered by a patent, I trust.
Remarkable. Remarkable. It also conforms to certain facts and theories I shall now lay before you. You know, Doctor, I shouldn't be surprised if your application of my methods proves in the long run far more important than the mechanical uses I make of them. Now then, let me tell you a story. A wealthy widower with an only son he does not care for particularly and who does not care for him goes travelling to the United States. There he meets a young woman half his age, yet in spite of this disparity, or perhaps because of it, they fall in love. Knowing that his own years are numbered, they are married without delay. The woman comes from a well-to-do Quaker background, and the two are joined together in a Quaker church known as a meeting house. This phrase, later mumbled by our client, was understood by us as meet house. The couple returns to the isolated home of the husband in Bavaria, where the first thing the bridegroom does is to alter his will in favour of his bride. His respect for her religious views on the subject make it impossible for him to retain control of an empire dedicated to the manufacture of war material. Having neither the strength nor the inclination to devote his last years to the dismantling of his factories, he very simply puts the entire matter into her hands in the event of his death, to do with as she sees fit. The old gentleman, however, has not reckoned with the wrath of his prodigal son. Finding his hopes cut off literally from untold millions, this young devil proves capable of drastic steps to regain them. Politically conservative himself and raised in the new Germany, he possesses certain connections and he uses them. Offers are made to certain people, people who have no intention of allowing a foreign commoner to dismantle the core of the Kaiser's war machine. The young man is given carte blanche and is no doubt assigned some help. We have yet to discover how it was managed, but he somehow accomplishes the death of his father.
Holmes.
And then proceeds to spirit his stepmother out of Germany and into a garret near the Danube Canal here in Vienna. The father's will is on file in the two countries where he holds property, and the bride is now urged to sign over her interest to the son. This she courageously refuses to do. But in her lonely confinement, her mind begins to give way. Ingeniously, she manages to escape. When she is free, however, the utter hopelessness of her situation is borne in upon her. The bridge is the nearest and simplest solution, but passing constables prevent it, at which point she retreats into the catatonic state in which we found her.
But what of the lady we saw at the opera?
And the young man we are playing against is as bold as he is cunning. Upon learning that his stepmother has escaped, he makes a quick decision. He elects to ignore her. Let her tell her story to whoever can understand it. He would not make himself conspicuous by searching for her. He would hire someone to assume her place and bluff through the business of the will with a simple forged signature. For who, when all was said and done, would care to contest the widow's decision? I do not know where he discovered his clever pupil. Possibly she is the very maid she pretended to recognize, or else perhaps some American actress down on her luck and stranded far from home. But whoever she is, she has been coached well. Foreseeing the slim possibility that his stepmother would be discovered, he even provided her substitute with that convincing business about the missing maid. The question now...
Yo-yo!
Papa, this message was brought by an orderly from the hospital.
Let me see. This is from Dr. Schultz. He wonders what has become of the woman since she had been left in my hands.
They've taken her. Fool that I am to have thought they would hesitate whilst I stood babbling here. Fräulein Anna, ask your mother to tell the police to meet us at 76 Valentinsteinstrasse. Hurry, gentlemen, we have not a moment to lose. But we have nothing so much as a deranged woman at one end of our trail. There lurks a European conflagration at the other.
Holmes leapt into his Inverness and raced into the street, Dr. Freud and I hard behind him. We secured a cab and bid the driver hasten with all due speed to the Baron's residence, where we found the Viennese constabulary already in the grounds.
Herr Holmes, we have just arrived, but the house is closed and no one appears within.
As I surmised, we are too late.
This is not a reflection on us, I hope. We got here so soon as we were notified.
No. The fault is none of yours, though your men have made a fine mess of the ground. Could not be worse if the Lipizzaner stallions had performed here. Still, we may as well have a look.
Herr Holmes, your reputation is well known to us, and the prefect has ordered me to place my men at your disposal.
Really? It's a pity they don't share your prefect's views at the yard.
Holmes made a hasty examination of the area by the porte-cochere. Suddenly, he halted, his body quivering over some detail in the ground.
There is every indication they have placed the woman inside a large steamer trunk and are carrying her with them out of the country.
Where is he taking her?
Where? What? Where? Right, Bavaria, of course. Blast! If he leaves the country with her, we may never see her again. Quick, the station!
The startled driver thundered across Vienna, and we arrived at the Heiligenstadt Bahnhof some minutes later. Before we had stopped, Holmes was on the ground and racing into the building. When we caught up with him, he was already in excited conversation with the station master.
Baron von Leinstorff, of course I remember, but you have missed him. He commissioned a special. He has his own card, you know. I put together the train myself 3 hours ago.
Bound for München?
Yes.
We will also commission a special. That one right there, if you don't mind.
No! It takes time to put together a special and money. And we must telegraph ahead to clear the point.
Watson, your revolver, if you please.
Where was this train originally headed?
This is the Dresden local.
It is now the Bavarian Express.
You will be kind enough to accompany us.
But, no, we haven't enough fuel for München. And the points are all wrong.
We will cross the first obstacle when necessity compels us to. And as for the second, we will switch the points as we go.
I never get your limits, Watson. Off we go, then. Full speed, mind.
This is railway property. You cannot...
The Baron has abducted an American lady.
Who the devil are you?
My name is Sherlock Holmes.
Sherlock? We must peck the furnace with coal. Engineer, pour on all speed.
It was a sight I shall not soon forget. The world's greatest detective and the founding father of that branch of medicine known today as psychoanalysis, side by side, in their shirt sleeves, piling coal into that boiler as though it was work for which they'd been born.
How much fuel have we left?
If we make it to Steyr, we'll be lucky.
What else can we burn?
There is nothing else, I'm afraid.
Then we are lost.
I'm sorry, Herr Holmes.
Wait!
The one car we're pulling, it's made of wood?
Yes, but it is railway property.
We will take the responsibility.
But you cannot reach it without climbing over couplings. And at this speed...
Watson, hand me an axe.
Be careful, Holmes.
We took apart that unfortunate car and burned it piece by piece. As we tore through the night on our mad chase, that car disappeared entirely under our ministrations, and our speed did not slacken. By dawn's light, the city of Steyr was in plain view, when shouts from the engineer and station master drew us to the front of the demolished car. Wonder of wonders! Not 3 miles off, a train was heading southwest with an engine, a tender, and 3 cars in tow.
There they are!
May I go, you are a genius. Now we must pour on every ounce of steam we can. We must catch them before they cross the frontier.
We did as Holmes bid and rushed frantically about, heaping the boiler fires higher and whiter than ever with the fragments of that once proud railway carriage. The city of Steyr whipped past at a dizzying speed. Once through the station, it was only a matter of moments before the Baron's train reached the Danube. Oblivious to everything now, we scuttled the remains of that car faster than one would have supposed possible.
They turned the barrels!
Ram them!
Someone is on the rear platform!
The Baron!
Go! Madam, how can we put on more speed?
Release the platform!
We climbed through the empty tender and stood over the naked couplings, the ground rushing by below us at a fearful rate. Holmes straddled the huge iron claws, while I got on my stomach and held him firmly around the waist. He threw off the heavy emergency links and then proceeded to undo the revolving bolts. There was a sudden release and a great burst of speed. Had I not been holding fast, Holmes would have toppled to an instant death.
Never let them say you are merely my Boswell, Watson. Never let them say that.
We have burned every scrap of available material. We have released the iron wheels of our only carriage. There is nothing further to be done.
If we did not now close in on that train, all our efforts have been in vain.
The needle on the pressure gauge is dropping.
We have lost him.
Look ahead! Fire!
Holmes! He has released one of his cars!
Break!
I felt our wheels freeze beneath us and saw sparks fly in every direction from the rails as we struggled to avoid a collision. Everyone braced for the shock, but at the last moment we realized that we were not going to strike. After all, the vehicle was obeying the laws of momentum and was now traveling ahead of us through the mountains at a good clip. Holmes, perceiving the situation, threw off his Inverness and started round the camp towards the front of the locomotive.
He has made a fatal mistake. Keep her close, Berger, and put on every ounce you can. Watson, I'll trouble you for your service revolver.
What will you do?
What I can.
Holmes.
Watson, old man, if anything happens, you will think kindly of me, I trust.
It is necessary. I did not save your life to assist you in throwing it away again.
I can think of nothing else. Goodbye, Freud, and may God bless you for saving my life and for the services you will yet render mankind. Berger, keep her close.
Holmes climbed along the outside of the engine towards the car we were pushing before us as the Baron's train drew nearer and nearer still. In an instant, he made his way into the empty carriage. As we wound among those stupendous mountains, Berger imitated precisely the openings and closings of the other engine's throttle.
Timmy! Pistol shots!
Look! Someone is climbing onto the roof of the car!
It's the Baron!
Off for my revolver! Where is Holmes?
There! Climbing after him!
It was Sherlock Holmes. And like the Baron, he carried a revolver and a saber. Though how these weapons chanced to be aboard the train, I did not learn until afterwards. The two men faced each other at opposite ends of the trembling car. The Baron whipped round his revolver and fired. The shot went wide. He tried again as Holmes inched forward, but the gun had jammed. With a furious gesture, he hurled it aside. In automatic response, Holmes brought up his own weapon and aimed it.
Shoot, Holmes! Shoot!
If he heard as he gave no sign, nor did he pay any heed when we tried to warn him of the approaching tunnel. But at the last minute, he divined the danger and flattened himself to the roof, the pistol flying from his hand as he did so.
When we again burst into the daylight, we discerned the combatants with swords in their hands.
If you want the woman, you'll have to fight for her. It will be my honor, Aaron.
In an instant, they grappled, and their blades crossed, flashing in the clear sunlight. Back and forth, they slashed and thrust, struggling to maintain their footing as they fought. Neither was an amateur. Truth forces me to confess, however, that the Baron was Holmes' superior with the saber. He pressed him slowly, relentlessly back to the end of the car, his satanic features grinning with anticipation as he perceived his advantage. Then Freud shouted into the wind,
"Holmes! No backhand! No backhand!"
Holmes thrust to the Baron's backhand. He parried clumsily, and Holmes impaled him. The Baron drew back with such force that the saber hilt was wrenched from my friend's hand. The Baron stood for a moment on the carriage roof, swaying, his evil face immobile with shock. And then with an awful cry, he plunged over the side. At once, Holmes climbed to the end of the car and descended onto the platform between carriages. Freud and I followed by crossing through the car. On its walls were armorial mementos, and it was from one of these gilded crests that Holmes and the Baron had seized their weapons. In desperate haste, we began our search amongst innumerable trunks and portmanteau.
Look for air hose. Here!
Holmes seized the sword and slid its blade behind the lock of an enormous trunk. With a mighty effort, he tore loose the catch, and he and I together threw back the clasps and forced the thing open on its massive hinges. And there, alive, unharmed, and in much the same condition as we had left her, her blue-gray eyes open but unseeing, sat Nancy Osborne Slater von Leinsdorf.
Is she all right?
She will be.
And now let us stop these trains.
The next night, we were once again settled in Freud's study.
No, we've not really prevented a war. The most we can be said to have done is to have postponed it.
But...
Now, it's no secret that fleets are building up at Scarpa Flow, and if the Kaiser wishes to go to war with Russia over the Balkans, he will find the means to do so. With the Baron dead and the Baroness incapable, it would not astonish me to learn that the German government has declared the will null and the estates infested. At that time, you and I, Dr. Freud, may find ourselves on opposing sides.
I cannot doubt the truth of your prophecy. Perhaps all our labors have failed nothing.
Well, I should not go quite that far. We have, after all, gained time. You recall Marvell's choice phrase, Watson, had we but world enough and time.
Mm.
Well, what the world needs desperately is time. If our work has gained but an hour more in which to understand the human predicament, it shall not have been in vain.
There are other benefits of a more immediate nature to show for our work. For one thing, we've rescued that unfortunate woman from a fate worse than death. And for another...
And for another, Dr. Freud has saved my life. Your hypnotic therapy has rescued me from a terrible addiction, and beyond that, your judgment has saved my life. Your judgment and Watson's here. For him, there will be a lifetime to repay the debt. What can I do for you?
I'll tell you what I should like. Let me hypnotize you once more before you leave.
But I tell you, I'm cured.
It has been observed that the proper study of mankind is man. I thought you might permit me to peer once more into your brain. There is another part of your mind to which I would also like to say farewell.
If you insist.
Holmes, keep your eye on my watch, please. Now, listen carefully to my voice. I'm going to ask you some questions, and you will answer them. When you're finished, I will snap my fingers, and you will awaken. When you do, you will remember nothing that has taken place while you were asleep. Do you understand?
Perfectly.
Very well. When did you first use cocaine?
When I was 20.
Where?
University.
Why?
I was unhappy.
Why did you become a detective?
To punish the wicked and see justice done.
Have you ever known wickedness personally?
Yes.
What was that wickedness?
My mother deceived my father.
She had a lover.
Yes.
What was the injustice?
Mother? Mother?
What is it? What do you remember?
My father killed her.
Your father murdered your mother?
Yes.
And the lover, what became of him?
He fled.
Who was he? Who was he?
My tutor.
Your Professor Moriarty?
Oh, yes. Professor Moriarty.
All right. Sleep now. Sleep. I will awaken you shortly, and you'll remember nothing of this interview. Do you understand? Nothing.
I understand.
Good, good. Sleep now.
The Napoleon of crime.
What?
Holmes was right about him from the very beginning. Professor Moriarty, I mean.
It all becomes clear now. As he himself would observe, see how much is explained by these facts. We understand not only the origins of his addiction and his hatred of Professor Moriarty, but also his distrust of women. So well recorded by you, Doctor. And also his choice of profession. Detector of wickedness, punisher of injustice.
It also explains Mycroft Holmes' hold over Moriarty and his own eccentric behavior. Shut up in that club for an eternal bachelorhood. You are the greatest detective of them all.
I am a physician whose province is the troubled mind. Which means, in this case, simply that I have borrowed some of your friend's methods and applied them to himself. You will recall, Doctor, that we spoke of an area of the mind I called the unconscious. Well, he has led me to it, given me the clues himself.
But how?
I will confine myself to an observation made by your English playwright, the one he deduced I am so fond of reading. We are such stuff as dreams are made on. Take heart. Your friend is a functioning human being. Within the framework of his unhappiness, he is nevertheless successful and even beloved. Wake up, Herr Holmes.
Did I tell you anything of importance?
It was not very interesting, I'm afraid. Now we must hurry. Your train leaves within the hour, and my wife would like to say goodbye. You have made a conquest. My daughter wishes to study the violin. I hope you will keep this one, by the way, as a souvenir.
We left Vienna after a tearful goodbye with Frau Freud, little Anna Freud, and the maid who had been so kind during Holmes' convalescence. Holmes carried Sigmund Freud's violin. I often thought, during those dark years that opened this century, of Sigmund Freud's brief interior profile of the Kaiser, based on the observation of his withered arm. Though whether he was right or wrong in his conclusions, I cannot say. I was sufficiently distracted en route to be astonished when our cab came to a stop. Holmes? This is a steamship, not a train.
As always, Watson, little escapes your keen powers of observation. We are on a quay abutting the Danube.
We're going back to London.
You are, my dear fellow. I'm not. I need some time to myself, Watson. A little holiday.
Holmes, I don't like this at all. When will you return?
One day. In the meantime, inform my brother of my decision and tell Mrs. Hudson my rooms are not to be touched. Is that clear?
But
rest assured, my dear fellow, it's only that I must complete my recovery. Give my best to Mrs. Watson.
But how will you live?
You would do well to follow the concert career of a violinist named Sigerson.
But your readers, my readers, what will I tell them?
Anything you like. I know. Tell them.
I watched while the boat pulled away from the pier and steamed up the Danube. I stood for no little while on the dock, wondering when I would next see my friend. My own return trip to England was uneventful. I slept most of the way, the faithful Toby by my side. And when I stepped onto the platform at Victoria, there was my old dear girl waiting for me with a wide smile and open arms. And it will surprise no one to learn that when it came time to write down what had occurred, I followed Sherlock Holmes' advice to the letter.
Tell them I was murdered by my mathematics tutor. They'll never believe you in any case.
The part of Sherlock Holmes was played by Simon Callow. Dr. Watson, Ian Hogg, Sigmund Freud, Carl Johnson. Professor Moriarty and Dr. Schultz, David King. Mycroft and Berger, Philip Voss. Baron von Leinsdorf, Matthew Morgan. Nancy Osborne Slater von Leinsdorf, Melinda Walker. The bogus Baroness von Leinsdorf, Geraldine Fitzgerald. Hugo von Hoffmannsthal, Wolf Kehler. With David Bannerman, Kate Binchy, Federer Holmes, Jilly Mears, and David Sinclair. Music by David Chilton and Nicholas Russell Pavier. And the violin played by Steve Bentley. Technical presentation by Carol McShane, Rosamund Mason, and Anne Bunting. The 7% Solution was adapted by Denny Martin Flynn from the novel by Nicholas Meyer and directed by Jane Morgan.